I rise in the dawn and I kneel and blow till the seed of the fire flicker and glow. And then I must scrub and bake and sweep till stars are beginning to blink and peep. But the young lie long and dream in their bed of the matching of ribbons for bosom and head. Their day goes over in idleness. They sigh if the wind but lift up a tress, while I must work because I am old, and the seed of the fire gets feeble and cold. A poem called A Fairy Song was typical of that period. Dermot and Grania are the Irish Paris and Helen. Some countrymen told me that they slept under the cromlech. For that reason, I called my poem A Song Sung by the People of Fairy Over Dermot and Grania in Their Bridal Sleep Under a Cromlech. I call the people of Fairy old and gay, not old and grey, as it is sometimes misprinted.
We who are old, old and gay, oh, so old, thousands of years, if all were told, give to these children, new from the world, silence and love, and the long dew-dropping hours of the night and the stars above. Give to these children, new from the world, rest far from men. Is anything better? Anything better? Tell us it then. Us who are old, old and gay, oh, so old, thousands of years, if all were told.
He had to be absolutely alone, so completely alone that even when an infant was in the room and silent, he had still to be alone because no personality must be there at all. It wasn't a matter of merely being spoken to or interrupted or anything else, but it had been absolute isolation in a room wherever he was writing.
Well, now, what about, on the other hand, what about that lovely poem about Anne, your daughter, which reads as if it were written when she actually was there in the room and in the presence?
Well, she wasn't, actually. She was sleeping outside at Bellalee in the cradle by the river at Bellalee. And he could look out at her occasionally from a window from the stairs, or he could walk down the garden to her, but he certainly would not have written a poem if she'd been in the room. The poem to Michael was written, again, at the time when Michael was he wasn't ill, but it was a very questionable moment that whether he would live or not. He was a very small infant at the time. W.B. wrote that poem because he wasn't sure if Michael would live or not.
Well, now, I should like to hear that story about Michael. Was he going up the stairs and W.B. coming down?
Well, actually, that is a much later story. Michael must have been about 3 or even 4. His father had taken Anne Yates, his sister, who was 2.5 years older, to help him post some letters in the local post box. And Michael had not been taken, and he was very jealous. And one or two mornings later, when I was bringing him downstairs, he saw his father going to the bath, and he just looked over his shoulder and he said, "Who is that man?"
I remember Mother thinking that at one stage she thought that Father was getting tired in the evenings, and it'd be a good idea if his mind stopped going round in circles, I suppose, and he rested his mind. So she thought if he sent me in the evenings after dinner, I would talk to him, and he would listen to me and get rested. And the first evening I talked, and it was terribly heavy going. Both of us. The second evening I talked, and that was even more heavy going. And after that I gave in, and I threw a sort of stone into the river and let the ripples go. And I threw out a sort of remark, and then let him pick it up. And he talked the rest of the evening. And he was much happier. You know, so was I. It just didn't work. We weren't... Well, they were too dissimilar in ages.
How conscious were you of your father's involvement with the Abbey when you worked there?
At that time, I was very conscious of it. Indeed. In fact, I think I suspect I went around saying, "Father says, Father says, Father says," all the time. It's quite likely. I must have come back and complained on one occasion. There was a play of Father's, I think it was probably Boris Strand, and it was the winter, and a lot of them had to wear short tunics. It was very cold. And I remember having difficulty with a couple of old actors who refused to take off the long woolly johns. And what was I going to do with them? Sticking down. They kept falling down below their knees, you know. And I came back and complained bitterly to him about this, and I said, "Their knees are so knobbly anyway." And that gave rise to the poem that starts off all out of shape from toe to top. There's a story that the old Abbey lighting equipment was very crude. It was a few spots and a few floods, and the electrician had a positive passion for amber. And everything was bathed in amber light. And he couldn't get the effect that Father wanted. And Father was sitting in the darkened audience, and the lights were going up and down the stage, amber spots and amber floods. And suddenly Father said from the back of the audience, "That's it, Dossie." Dossie was the electrician's name. "That's it, Dossie. That's it. That's it exactly." And a voice from the back of the stage says, "The bloody thing's on fire."
Seemed to be a prodigious letter writer. Were you aware of him, you know, always writing or...
Oh, he was always writing. He was always working, put it this way. He used to... In the later years, he used to stay in bed in the morning and write. Every spare minute that he had, he used to work. He used to work in the mornings in bed, and then he'd get up for lunch or after lunch. And this would have been in the last 5 years of his life, I suppose. Sometimes, I remember earlier Mother telling me that at one time he couldn't work, or he had no inspiration, or things weren't going well, and he was depressed, and she decided he needed a change, so she took him away for a weekend on Glenloch, and just like that cast him off. And that was a great success, this sudden change, and he got on the rails again.
"Although I'd lie lapped up in linen, a deal I'd sweat and little earn if I should live as lived the neighbours," cried the beggar Billy Byrne. "Stretch bones till the daylight come on great-grandfather's battered tomb." Upon a grey, old, battered tombstone in Glendalough beside the stream, where the O'Byrnes and Byrnes are buried, he stretched his bones and fell in a dream of sun and moon that a good hour bellowed and pranced in the round tower, of golden king and silver lady bellowing up and bellowing round, till toes mastered a sweet measure, mouth mastered a sweet sound, prancing round and prancing up until they pranced upon the top. That golden king and that wild lady sang till stars began to fade. Hands gripped in hands, toes close together, hairs spread on the wind they made. That lady and that golden king could like a brace of blackbirds sing. It's certain that my luck is broken, that rambling jailbird Billy said. Before nightfall, I'll pick a pocket and snug it in a feather bed. I cannot find the peace of home on great-grandfather's battered tomb."
I remember him as always working and of having to be quiet because he was always working. He didn't care for childish voices. I think he liked to, the rather Victorian ideas.
Was he a strict father?
No, Mother was the one really who had to look after us. She was looked after him and us, and she was the one that if we did things wrong, she was the one who told us so. Except on one occasion, with Michael and I have been fighting rather more than usual, and Mother got fed up with him and said, I'm going to send your father to you. And we were so surprised at this. I remember we sat one each side of the mantelpiece and looked at each other and said, extraordinary, you know. This was quite unheard of. And after a long pause, he came up and he stood between us and he looked at us both and he recited that thing about little dogs delight to bark and bite. And then he went away, and that's all he said. And we were so flabbergasted, we didn't fight for hours. So that he wasn't really disciplinary in that sense, because Mother did it for him, you know.
Some wonderful little references, I think, to you when you were a baby about, you know, you, some childish behaviour.
Yes, he does. He makes only too many references sometimes, doesn't he?
You asking him to put on a pair of shoes, and when he offered help,
right,
you screwed up your toes. And
yes.
He referred to this on numerous occasions.
That's right, yes. As the sort of the dawning of the female flirtatiousness.
And also on the occasion when you were ill.
Apparently I had scarlet fever, and in those days when you'd had scarlet fever, rooms got disinfected, toys got, clothes got burnt, and all the rest of it. And my favourite doll had to be burnt. So Father scoured Dublin. At that time, there were several full-time toy shops in Dublin. Scoured Dublin for a doll and succeeded in finding an exact duplicate. But I wouldn't have anything to do with it. I wouldn't look at it. And Mother said the silly man was terribly hurt by that, not realising, of course, that my doll had the ages worn off, and, of course, I'd know the difference.
We were discussing earlier the way in which he travelled a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
This must have been a bit difficult as a child.
Yes, we started... We start off in Main Square, and then that had to be disbanded because Father had to go out and spend the winters in Italy for his health. And they took a flat in Italy, and then Michael and I went to Switzerland, and we spent the school months in Switzerland. And I remember on one occasion Basil Bunting was sent to collect us from Switzerland, from Italy. He went from Italy to Switzerland, bring us back to Italy, and we spent our holidays in the flat with Mother and Father in Italy, and then we're back to Switzerland. I don't remember anything that he said or did there, except he's falling through the deck chair on the balcony, which I thought was terribly funny, and Mother didn't. That was funny, he was recovering from an illness, you see, and I thought it was terribly funny that he's fallen through the deck chair. Mother didn't, because he probably set him back for days in his health, you know. But it just seemed to me that see Father stuck in a perhaps because he was so dignified and so big and so tall and so large, that the spectacle of him being stuck in a day chair was too much for me. After that, then, we came back to Ireland. I suppose it would have been about that time we kept commuting down to Galway too, of course, down Tower Bay Lee. The Tower, I liked the Tower. It was a lovely place for children to be. And Father used to go up on the flat roof there. And we were never allowed up in the Tower, Michael and I. The theory being that the stone circular steps were dangerous. We might fall down them. So they had peace up there in the Tower. And Father used to go up and sit in the top of the Tower on the flat roof there and write.
Now that we're almost settled in our house, I'll name the friends that cannot sup with us. Beside a fire of turf in the ancient Tower, and having talked to some late hour, climb up the narrow winding stair to bed. Discoverers of forgotten truth, or mere companions of my youth, all are in my thoughts tonight, being dead.
Yes, he was very fond of the Tower, wasn't he?
He was very fond of the Tower, yes.
Because I think there's a reference somewhere to him hoping that his children will sort of keep it as it is, or as it was then.
That's right, yes. Well, it became economically impossible until it was taken over. And I would have liked us to have kept it on and gone down there, but he wasn't well enough, and it was very damp down there. The walls used to run, the limestone walls used to run with moisture when it rained. It really wasn't very practical. The water went, see, there was... Well, nearly three-quarters of the way around it, and used to rise higher and higher and higher, and it used to rise up over the... flood the cottages, the two cottages, and the downstairs room in the Tower. And then when that happened, then Mother used to send Michael and I, and Nana, our nurse, up to Lady Gregory's in the Troponian Trap, and she and father would climb up into the upstairs in the tower with the linen and the silver and the paper and what have you, leaving the furniture presumably to float about downstairs. And then they'd sit the flood out, and then when the flood went down, she would come out and sweep out the mud and the worms, and then father would come down and we'd come back. I mean, that was a fairly annual occurrence. But I mean, of course, they were down there during the Troubles too, during part of the Troubles. They, I forget which study was, said that they had to blow up the... This ours was the last road left, ran immediately outside the tower and across the bridge, which is immediately one corner of the tower. And it was the last open road left, and they said they'd have to come and blow it up. They were very sorry about it, but it had to be done. And they suggested that they reopened all the windows in the tower and stuffed the children's ears with cotton wool, and they blew it up. They blew up the road. They blew up the bridge, actually. And they didn't do it terribly well. There was enough room for a horse and cart to get across it. But all the windows were smashed. And the river that ran... there was one bit of river that was very deep and it was forbidden. But there was an enormous stretch of river that was very wide and very shallow and quite harmless. And we could paddle around there. And then father wanted ducks. He thought ducks would be nice to add to the livestock. And mother stood out against a duck. She had enough with children and poets. And he kept saying, must have ducks. And he said, no, Willie, we will not have ducks. And then apparently one day he said, he was without thinking, he said, now, what colour should we paint that duck house, George? Oh, I forgot, we're not going to have any ducks. And her mother gave up then, apparently. She said, all right, we'll have ducks. So we had a duck house, and we had a couple of white Aylesbury ducks. And it used to be mother's job and my job to put them to bed every night. We had to put them to bed at night, because I forget whether it was the locals who would steal them and the rats would eat them, but anyway, we had to put them to bed at night. And you got one duck up the duck board and you got it in the door and you shut the door, you see. And then he went back and he got the next duck and he got it up the door and he opened the door and the first duck came out. And I didn't go to bed till it was finished, so I thought this was a great game. I enjoyed it very much. I must be about 7 or 8 at the time, I suppose. And I liked those ducks. I remember an old man passing the road and watching us and saying, well, you're lucky they're not, you're lucky them's not turkeys. They'd be up the tops of the trees. Mother had sunflowers outside the back door, the front door, the cottage door, and an old woman was passing one day, and she disapproved of the sunflowers. She said that mother should be very careful to keep the children's mouths covered when they pass the sunflowers, because lizards would jump out of the sunflowers into the children's mouths, and that would be a bad thing. So I've heard that since. And you have to hold the children upside down over the... You have to feed them salty things, I think it is. And then hang them with their mouths open over the water, and then the lizard jumps out to get a drink of water and falls out of the children's mouths. I remember Mother and I hiding in there. We had a swing seat there, and we hid in the swing seat one day with our feet up, so our feet couldn't be seen below the level of the seat, because there was an old woman coming down the road. It was really rather a nuisance. She was half mad anyway.
Were you born in... the house in St. Stephen's Green, which was loaned to him by Maud Gonne?
No, I was born in a maternity home in Hatch Street, I think, or Fitzwilliam Street. Fitzwilliam Street, I think it was. And I'm told that when father went to visit mother for the first time after I was born, he was seen on the steps with a bag of sweets in his hand for his daughter. But I don't know if that's true or not.
We were aware of him actually, writing... sitting at a desk writing.
Yes, he used to. I have seen him at a desk. He had a very long, kind of refectory table. This was in Rathfarnham. This would have been the last 5 years, and he used to write at that table. It was a very long room, the drawing room, and a long narrow room. It, I think, was probably two rooms made into one before we came there. And one end of the room was where he used to sit and talk with friends, and the other end of the room was where he used to write. And I remember somebody telling me a story of Oliver St. John Gogarty, who came to see him one evening and started to walk up and down the room, and he was talking. And I mean, Gogarty walked up and down the room, and he got nearer and nearer to the father's table where he write, and then he got up the table and he took a piece of paper and he picked up a pen, and then he suddenly threw them down and said, "No, Willie, I'm damned if I will." And father had been playing a joke on Gogarty. He'd been willing him to draw a donkey and write his name under it, just for fun, you know. And he'd almost persuaded him to do it. But he wasn't much given to jokes like that. Whoever prompted it.
I think Yeats's closest friend in Dublin after the 20s was Oliver Gogarty. He'd known Yeats as a young man, Gogarty had, and Gogarty had known Yeats. In fact, Gogarty was the man who gave the, what one might call a literal trans of the Oedipus version that Yeats eventually did. Gogarty was a fine Greek scholar in Trinity. He was, of course, also Buck Mulligan in Joyce's Ulysses, and Yeats was later to call him one of the great lyric poets of our age. He had a very high, perhaps some people felt over, exaggerated feeling for Gogarty's poetry, but he put 17 of them in the Oxford Book of Modern Verse, and only three of T.S. Eliot. However, he really admired Gogarty in the 20s. Gogarty, I think, seemed to him the symbol of the outrageous Irishman, with his wild Rabelaisian wit, his gallant style, his panache. It was a mixture of the two things that Yeats liked. He saw Gogarty's outrageousness has been typical of the Gael, and he saw his daring and his gallantry has been typical of the 18th century Anglo-Irish Protestant, what Yeats called the swift and different men, the wild horsemen of the West who used to gallop at a five-bar gate without blinking an eyelid. Lady Gregory's cousins, of course, were those sort of people. The Peirce brothers, or her brothers, I should say, the famous Peirce brothers of the West. Yeats admired them a lot, and he was always trying to find a blending between the two, what he called the landlord duelists that were and the peasant visionaries that are. He wanted them to unite in one great Celtic phantasmagoria. And in Gogarty's wild wit, I think he thought there had been a meeting between the two. So it was when, in 1923, Gogarty was captured by the anti-treaty forces during the Civil War and perpetrated an act which was to become part of the legend of Dublin. The Yeats joined joyfully in the ceremony that occurred after the capture of Gogarty. What actually happened was this. Gogarty was in his consulting rooms one day. He'd just been made a senator of the new Free State. And some people came into his rooms, pretended they were patients, and absconded, or took Gogarty out, kidnapped him. They were Republicans, and they were holding him against the execution of a prisoner in Dundalk. They took him out to the to a house near Island Bridge. As they got out of the car, Gogarty said to one of them, "Aren't you going to tip the driver?" "Ah, no, that's it," the fellow. And then he slipped. He pleaded, as he later said, a natural necessity, and was taken to the edge of the river, and he slipped his arms out of his coat and fired himself into the foaming tide 40 feet below, and amid the hail of bullets and up to his neck in the freezing water, he vowed he would present two swans to the goddess of the river if he survived. He did survive, and 2 years later, after he'd been in England, he came back and presented the swans to the river. And had as his companion in this symbolic gesture to the goddess of the River Liffey, Yeats, who was delighted, of course, to take part in what one might call a Dublin event, which he knew would pass into history as it has, because people say in Dublin today that all the swans on the Liffey are descendants of Gogarty swans, that there were no swans beforehand. The ceremony wasn't quite as symbolic as it has been made to sound afterwards, because the swans wouldn't leave the box. And there was Yeats on one side, President Cosgrave, the first president of the Free State, on the other, and Gogarty in the middle. Yeats was chanting away and saying, "Oh, Gogarty, what terrible events might follow if this vow was to be unfulfilled." And Gogarty was saying, "All I want to do is get these bloody birds out of the box." And he's afraid to pull them by the neck for fear he'd strangle them, and pull them by the wing for fear they'd break his arm. In the end, he gave it a good root with his left foot, and the pair of swans emerged like torpedoes and sped up the Liffey while Yeats chanted away, and that's how the swans were presented to the Liffey. This seemed to have unleashed something in both Yeats and Gogarty, because it was after this that Gogarty published his first book of verse called An Offering of Swans, and, of course, Yeats's great poem, Lead on the Swan, was germinated during this period, and he has himself in his letters and writings, described how he and Gogarty would often talk together about the legend of Leda and who was part of the third egg that was laid, or who was emerged from the third egg. And Yeats's sonnet was germinated during this time, that great sonnet, you know, a shudder in the loins engenders there the broken wall, the burning roof and tower and Agamemnon dead. Gogarty had another version of Leda, which he wrote to the tune of Goosey Goosey Gander. Leda's mother told her not to go a-bathing. You remember, Goosey Goosey Gander, where shall I wander? Upstairs or downstairs or in my lady's chamber? Leda's mother told her not to go a-bathing. Leda loved the water, she wouldn't stay away. Wandering by its freshness when the noon was even, wading in the water at the break of day. And then she gets into the water. In without a stitch on, peaty water yielded, till her head was lifted with its ropes of hair, you would say as lovely as a lily gilded, just to see how golden was her body there. Then Leda sees the swan, and she doesn't know what to call him. What was there to call him but Goosey Goosey Gander? Leda knew no other way to call a swan. And the bird responding seemed to understand her, for he left his sailing on the banks to waddle on. Then there's a sort of a three-dimensional coupling, and Leda goes to tell her mother what has happened. Of the tales that daughters tell their poor old mothers, some by all accounts are often very odd. But Leda's was a story stranger than all others. What was there to say but glory be to God? When the hyacinth and eggs were in the basket, blue as the whiteness where a cloud begins, who could dream there lay there all that Trojan brightness, Agamemnon murdered and the mighty twins? Of course, behind Yeats's back, Gogarty was always telling the most outrageous stories about him, but Yeats didn't really mind. I think he liked it. He knew this was part of the game. If he was to have his ear close to the reservoir of the wild, barbaric spirit of the Gael, he had to pay the price. Once when Yeats left an evening at which Gogarty was present, Padraig Colum said to him, he said, you know, Yeats said as he was going out, he said, he's very witty, isn't he? He said about Gogarty to Colum. Colum said, well, of course, you know, Yeats, Gogarty's probably doing an imitation of you just now. And Yeats went back, and sure enough, there was Oliver doing an impersonation of Yeats winning the Nobel Prize. And what he used to do was he would present Yeats, you see, getting the check from the King of Sweden with his head in the air, great lordly mien of Yeats, and he would walk off with his head in the air and immediately get into the wings. He'd grab the check out and have a look to see how much it was for. And he used to tell the famous story, of course, about how when Smiley the Irish Times rang up Yeats and said, Yeats, you've just won the Nobel Prize. What a wonderful honour it is for Ireland that you, Yeats, our greatest poet. Listen, cut the cackle, Smiley, and tell me how much is it for? Well, that was the sort of thing Gogarty used to say about Yeats. And as I say, Yeats didn't mind it at all. He almost relished it, all these stories that he knew Gogarty was telling about him. Once Gogarty came into him when Yeats was very ill, and he had a letter from a Spanish doctor in which the letter said, here we have a patient, and it was about Yeats, in an advanced stage of arteriosclerosis, and Gogarty didn't want to give the letter to Yeats, but Yeats insisted on having it, and Gogarty watched him as he read the letter, this great hierarchic figure with the white hair brushed back from the burnished forehead, sitting up in bed, and instead of horror coming over Yeats' face, he saw a look of voluptuous joy as Yeats began to savour the words and his hand began to beat up and down, arteriosclerosis, arteriosclerosis. Oh, Gogarty, said, I'd rather have that disease than be Lord of Lore Egypt.